This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Desert Research Institute, home of the Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas, Nevada. We're here at the invitation of Nevada Public Radio and the Las Vegas Centennial to help celebrate the 100th birthday of a city whose skyline is part Paris, part Manhattan, and part theme park, and all Las Vegas. Architecture here is a competitive sport, a critical part of the cutthroat competition to attract people into this building rather than that one. The newest yardstick is the $2.7 billion Wynn Las Vegas mega casino, which opened just 2 weeks ago.
Oh, it's fantastic. I'm staying down at Caesars, but I wanted to come in and see what all the buzz was about. The whole shop area, it seems like it's got everything.
Yeah, $2.7 billion, it should be pretty nice, huh?
And if we had left without seeing this, we were going to get chewed out by friends.
I have friends back home that said, you know, you have to go to the Wynn because we vacation here like every other year. So they said, how is it? Ooh, it's nice.
We got pictures.
It's very soothing in the sense of because of the garden, the flowers when you walk in. Not that I've been to Japan, but when you see pictures of Japan and all the different flowers that are out, and so it kind of gives that feeling to me.
I'm from Europe, I'm from Paris, and I think Las Vegas is catching up, or is better than Paris for tourists, really. It's a lovely building, I think it's amazing.
Jay from Pasadena, California, Michael from Washington State, Lucretia and Sharon from Henry, Illinois, Marva from Los Angeles, and Carl from Paris, France. Today's casino has come a long way from frontier gambling halls, neon cowboys, a long way from Elvis and the Rat Pack, too. These days, the people behind the glitz are often MBAs. Ivy League economists use mathematical models to maximize profits for publicly traded companies whose shares might even be in your stock portfolio. The buildings themselves are precisely planned so that every cranny, carpet pattern, and odor is calculated. Of course, you can't take the element of chance out of the games themselves, but casino planners, designers, and engineers do everything they can to remove risk from every other facet of the business. Later on in the program, Las Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman will join us to give us his vision of the future of Las Vegas. But first, as America's attitudes towards gambling changes, so does the modern-day casino. If you're in the business of planning, building, or designing these mega structures, give us a call. We'd also like to hear from those of you who have visited casinos in Las Vegas and elsewhere. What works? What doesn't? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Bo Bernhardt joins us now. He's director of gambling research at UNLV, the co-author of an article called Maverick to Mafia to MBA. And it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here.
Well, speaking of a maverick to MBA, your family history kind of parallels all this development.
We sort of epitomize that development. I'm, in fact, a fifth-generation Las Vegan, which makes me statistically a bit weird.
Unique, I might say.
Yes. My great-great-grandfather was a fellow by the name of Kid Jordan. They don't even have names like that anymore. Kid Jordan was a cowboy type who got chased out of Texas because he was running illegal casinos out there. He came out to Las Vegas. We had legalized in the 30s. Most recently, we've legalized gambling 3 times, in fact, and knew he could get work out here. Along the way, family legend goes, he stopped off in New Mexico where he shot the sheriff. So my life is like a Bob Marley song. and no word on the status of the deputy. But on his way out here, he got into quite a bit of trouble. But Las Vegas accepted him. And in that way, Las Vegas was sort of the Australia of the United States this is where we sort of sent our convicts. And I say that affectionately. I said this, in fact, in a lecture in Australia I gave last year. But it was where people like Kid Jordan could be accepted and find work and was then a very deviant occupation. And so, he was an individual that fit in those days in a deviant locale.
Well, in those days, it was the gambling hall, a glorified saloon in a way, I guess.
Right.
How did the gaming floor evolve?
The gaming floor looked very different back then. When you think about the gambling saloons, they were very much table game oriented, very sort of social environments. And in fact, when you look at today's casino floor, we've seen what we might call sort of a post-industrial deforestation effect, whereby these machines have sort of encroached upon lands formerly occupied by these tables, which are sort of an endangered species that are being sawed down and hauled off despite this recent poker boom. And this machinization has really changed the face of the casino, if you will.
As these machines take over, one thing that is sort of sad is to walk through a casino and see a lonely blackjack dealer at a table where there's nobody playing. But people seem to me are critical to the operation we always call it gaming. Gambling is what they're doing there. Do people, when they come into a casino, do they want to interact with a person or do they want to enter some sort of zone?
I think it depends. Certainly some people like to recreate sort of alone with the machines. The social scientist Robert Putnam wrote a bestseller a few years back called Bowling Alone, might remember, which suggested this isn't just true of gaming. This is true of recreation more broadly speaking. We tend to engage in interaction with machines more often in more isolated recreational activities, and gaming is no exception. We're seeing machines becoming an increasingly important component of the casino floor. That's not to say, certainly, that the more people-oriented games aren't important anymore. And certainly, this recent poker boom may be an exception to this sort of machinization process.
Well, you've talked about the Maverick period, and I guess we watch the movies, so we know a little bit about the Mafia period. When did the NBAs come into it?
You can look at the current leadership in a lot of the different major casino companies. Somebody like Gary Loveman of Harrah's is a former Harvard Business School professor. Somebody like Steve Wynn is a Wharton grad. Glenn Schaefer graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I think Terry Lanney, who's CEO of MGM Mirage, could have been CEO of anything. So increasingly we're seeing with this recent generation people who quite frankly could be operating any business in America. We're seeing that over at the university level across the street here, where a number of general managers of casinos here locally are coming back to school for master's degrees and PhDs because they see that as a necessary credential to operate tomorrow's casino.
If you have questions about the casinos of today or tomorrow, their design, what they're doing to separate you from whatever's inside your wallet, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're also getting questions from people here in the audience at the Desert Research Institute. Why don't we begin there?
Hi, thanks. My name is Susan Reynolds, and my question is, what sort of impact was there on the Las Vegas community when the casinos changed from family-run to corporate-run?
That's a good question, and I'm sorry, in thinking academically about Las Vegas, you have to sort of separate myth from reality. A lot of us think that the sort of family-oriented period was perhaps overblown, was more a media creation than it was, in fact, something that was enacted in casino operations up and down the Strip. But certainly, in a recent period of expansion, the MGM Grand, for example, when it opened, had a full-fledged theme park in the backyard. And what's happened is I think we've recognized that our core audience isn't the Disneyland crowd, it's the adult Disneyland crowd, and that in fact those are the individuals that we're targeting today.
Let's get a caller on the line, and with us is Kim. Kim's calling from Ithaca, New York.
Hi. I had my first trip to Las Vegas a couple years ago, and I didn't do any gambling, but I had a great time. My favorite things were the fountains at the Bellagio, and there's a ride called the Big Shot at the top of the Stratosphere Hotel and Casino, and the Stratosphere is a really tall building already, and then this ride, the Big Shot, just shoots you up even higher up into the air, and the way the ride is designed, you don't see the thing that you're sitting on, and so you feel like you're a bird. You really feel like, I mean, you have an eagle's eye view of Las Vegas and the surrounding area. It was amazing.
You came to Las Vegas, and you didn't gamble.
I did put one quarter in a slot machine just to say I had done it. It didn't win anything.
and were you a winner?
No, not a winner.
Shock.
But I had a great time. It was really a great trip. We also got to see the Smothers Brothers there, and a couple. They have some really low price shows. You can get lunch and a variety show for $12 a person. It was amazing. We had a great time.
Kim,
it was
thanks.
Two adults, just a few days, but well worth the trip.
Thanks, Kim, very much. Bo, isn't what Kim talking about, this sort of the theme park, that was one of the great innovations of Steve Wynn to attract people here for the attractions, not just the gambling.
Sure, and it's also, I think, a metaphor more broadly for what's happening on the Las Vegas Strip. Every time one of these places opens, it's like opening a new ride at Disneyland. And it might sound weird for people around the country to hear about this sort of nostalgia, but growing up in this town, every time there was a new mega resort opening, this was a big event. These were big deals for us. And so this recent opening of Wynn Las Vegas was something that that was very meaningful for all of us.
Well, joining us now is Jan Jones, Senior Vice President of Communications at Harrah's Casino Hotels. We're hearing about Steve Wynn, who's a one model. Another is Gary Loveman, the brain behind Harrah's and its great success. He's less well known.
Well, less well known in different circles. Gary's sort of a novelty in the gaming industry because it's counterintuitive to expect a Harvard professor to be running a casino.
And an MIT-trained guy who has taken a different approach towards making his casinos a success. Harrah's, you don't want to say it's a little not as glitzy as some of the other hotels, let's put it that way.
You know, I think that Harrah's was always gambling-centric, but Gary's approach is customer service-based. If you go back historically, Bill Harrah built his entire business on customer service. What Gary Loveman has done is take loyalty programs and managing relationships, rewarding your best customers, and really integrated it into the whole philosophy of the gambling experience. So it's not really different. It's just more exact.
And one of the things he does, I'm afraid there's just a few seconds left in this segment, but one of the things he does is track every activity that everybody does in the casino.
No, what he does is if you are part of the loyalty program, he tracks what you do as a customer so he can determine, it's not Gary can determine, the company
right.
can determine what is it you like. Are you incented by rooms? Do you prefer buffets? The same way that loyalty programs with airlines, Neiman Marcus, understand their customer, Harrah's has made a science of understanding their customer so that they can reward a customer with amenities that are meaningful to them.
We're talking about today's casino experience. Out on the Strip, you can risk your money in the opulence of Italy or in the pyramids of ancient Egypt. Where does the industry go next? If you're a casino fan, what do you want to see next? 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. We're going to take a short break. I'm Neil Conan, live in Las Vegas. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the auditorium at the Desert Research Institute in Las Vegas, Nevada. With the rise of riverboat and Indian casinos, gambling is an increasingly national entertainment, but the Strip just gets more sophisticated. Las Vegas remains the Mecca. Today we're talking with experts about what goes into the creation of today's highly orchestrated casino experience. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. If you're a casino frequenter, what would your dream casino have other than looser slots or maybe better odds? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Our guests with me here are Bo Bernhard, Director of Gambling Research at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, and Jan Jones, Senior Vice President of Communications for Harrah's Casino Hotels. And let's begin with a question from the audience here in Las Vegas.
Hi, Don Tamir, and I have a question about casino economics. How long will it take Steve Wynn to pay off that $2.7
billion? Jan, you work for the competition. I don't know. What would you guess?
Well, it's interesting. My money is always on Steve. I think he's perfectly brilliant. And I think that the estimates are that he has to make $3 million a day to service his debt. I expect he'll make that and more. How long and whether he's even worried on paying off his debt is his major goal, I don't think is the question. I think the question is, will Steve be extraordinarily successful? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Do you see him as a competitor or as a partner?
Steve's a partner. Steve, you have to understand, in 1989, when he envisioned the Mirage, there was nothing that was close. It was a billion-dollar property, and everybody bet that he could not succeed. Took $1 million to service his debt then. And he proved everybody wrong because he showed the competition. People want more. They want attractions. They want food. They want shopping. He's what drove the change from gaming revenue to non-gaming revenue as the biggest percentage of money coming into the Las Vegas Strip. So when he brings the level of entertainment to a higher standard, he brings in more tourists, more people that understand that gaming is sport, gaming is fun. People come to Las Vegas because they have a good time. They don't come to Las Vegas because they think they're going to strike it rich. And Steve plays on that emotion and teaches all of us how to better manage our customer relations and better manage our customer experiences, in my opinion.
Bo?
I agree with Jan. I think it'd be difficult to overemphasize the importance of the Mirage opening in 1989, and we've heard the story of how that transformed the Strip into more of a mega resort-oriented street. But it also changed more broadly what the community aspired to be and what we sort of shot for in terms of what we were selling to the broader population. And not coincidentally, that was the point at which Las Vegas really took off in terms of the population and the economy.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Rita. Rita's with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, thank you. I just was curious to know what impact, if any, the widespread casinos, Indian-operated casinos, is having on Las Vegas, if it is having any impact. The casinos here in and around Tulsa are burgeoning. 150-room hotel opened up 6 months ago at Catoosa, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Tulsa, and 18-hole golf course is adjacent to it. Every amenity you can imagine, including the high-end restaurant steakhouses and non-smoking entire sections of it, non-smoking. I just think they have got to be having some impact on Las Vegas.
Rita, you were talking, you couldn't hear the chuckles over the idea of a 150-room hotel when a 5,000-room one just opened.
Oklahoma with a population.
I understand, but I was just trying to explain to people why they were hearing laughter there. Bo, are they, it's not just in Oklahoma. Of course, there are big Indian casinos in California, New York. What is it? Gambling of some sort or another is legal in 40 states now?
48 of the 50 states have some form of legalized gambling. And I want to say to Rita, too, we actually are giving classes right now across the street at UNLV that are beamed to Catoosa for gaming operations management. This still remains sort of a mecca, I think, of gaming education. But more broadly, a lot of people wondered when gaming expanded as it did across the United States, is this going to hurt Las Vegas? And one school of thought was that people were going to be able to go around the corner and gamble, and this would really hurt Las Vegas. Another school of thought held that this would, in fact, benefit Las Vegas because it would expose more people to gambling, more people would see how much they could enjoy the gambling activities, and, in fact, more people would want to visit the so-called mecca of gambling here in Las Vegas. The latter theory has, I think, been proven to be true here.
Jen?
You really see that Harrah's manages five Indian casinos, and what you find, and a number of riverboats and casinos across the country, as people are exposed to gambling entertainment, they find they like it. It's a night out. And so it doesn't begin to compete. It builds the market. I mean, you've seen it when Atlantic City opened it. Everybody said this is the end of Las Vegas. It just grew Las Vegas. When Mississippi and the Gulf Coast opened, they were worried that that would erode. The Indian Casino in North Carolina, and I find this fascinating, is the number one tourist destination in all of North Carolina. Which is fascinating, but it's because of the experiential aspects, not just because of the gambling.
Business models aside, what does it take to conceive, design, and execute today's highly orchestrated casino experience? Architect Brad Friedmutter should know. He started working with Steve Wynn. He's been in the business of designing casinos for 30 years now. His latest project is the Red Rock Station, an $800 million casino resort that's in the work right now. Brad, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
What is it like to have the opportunity to spend $800 million?
Well, it's quite exciting in terms of architecture, and I've been in this, as you pointed out, for many, many years, and the budgets are extreme, and also the time frame in which they're done is extremely fast. Projects of comparable size and economics usually take 2, 3, 4, 5, times as long, many, many years. This type of money is spent within usually a 24 to a 36 month time frame.
Designing a casino has to be really different from building an office building or even a normal hotel.
Yes, it's quite different. An office building usually is built by a developer and then leased out to different tenants. The hotel itself has, generally speaking, a different occupancy and the type of customer that comes to it. The hotel casino, with entertainment, with restaurants, with sports, and all the related facilities, is quite different because of the integration and complexity between each of the departments. The hotel caters to customers as well as its own sales, convention sales, et cetera. The relationship of all of these things is critical. The synergy and proximity, you don't want to have things too spread out. Naturally, when you start to have 3,000 and 4,000 room hotels, it does take on a bit of a trek at times.
Mm-hmm. And were we right at the beginning when we said everything is calculated down to the smell?
Yes, but again, it's calculated, but there has to be adjustments because at the end of the day, it's what the market says, what the market does. It's totally market driven. What you think might work, there's a delicate balance of tried and true and working outside the box. When you start to bring those two things together, there's somewhat of experimentation, and you have to adjust after the public and your customers start to experience.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, one of the guiding principles we've always heard, and Jen, you would know about this, about casinos, is you don't want, there's no clocks, and you don't want to see daylight. You don't want no windows to the outside.
You know, that's really sort of the old perception of casinos. I think if you walk into Bellagio, if you walk into Wynn, if you walk into Mirage, there are a number of outside aspects because what they learned was as people are walking up and down the street, you want to incent them to come in, walk through. They don't need to be staying there. You want them to spend some time. So that old perception of no doors, no windows, I mean, you can go into Mandalay and you can go to the Four Seasons and never be in a casino. So it's entirely different today in its design and how they treat the customer.
And is it right, Brad, that the casino is just one profit center of a complex?
Yes, absolutely. Years ago, everything else was pretty much loss leader giveaway. Today, each of the areas pretty definitely so is a profit center in and of itself. However, I don't think you could ever lose sight that the main generator still is the casino customer, and that has to be catered to ultimately.
And I think that's true, but I think you also have to recognize in a market like Las Vegas that 65% of the revenues today are driven by non-gaming expenditures. They come from shows. They come from restaurants. You have the Forum, which is the highest grossing per square foot shopping center in the world. So you can't lose sight that gambling is the core. But it's not all about gambling today. In fact, just exactly the opposite.
Let's get another caller on the line. Andrew's calling from Gilroy, California.
Thanks for taking my call. I enjoy Vegas. I enjoy the bright lights, the gambling, especially blackjack and the shows. But what I don't like is the smoking, and I wonder if there have been studies done from a financial impact viewpoint regarding the allowance or disallowance of smoking. And I'll get hear your thoughts off the phone.
Well, Brad, is smoking going to be part of the casino you're building?
Yes, at Red Rock Station, smoking will be part of it. We pay a lot of attention to the mechanical and air circulation to get rid of that smoke. We use very expensive, very sophisticated systems designed by engineers. That cigarette smoke is something you do want to get rid of, so that people can smoke but not bother people next to them.
Let's get a question from the audience here.
Hi, my name is Lisa Weatherman, and I have a question for Brad. Why is the Mediterranean style so prevalent here in southern Nevada, especially since there's not a whole lot of water?
I would say that since people think of going away for 2 or 3 days, which is the average stay, when people think at their job, if you're in Chicago, you're in New York, you're in someplace else, it's wintertime, they would really like to go to the Mediterranean, but they can't. And I think when you start to talk about trees and water and suntan lotion, and pretty people doing pretty things. The Mediterranean comes to mind, and it's something that people can escape to for a 2 or 3 day period, and I think it's something that has a commonality amongst design.
I have one more question.
Go ahead, yeah.
Is there a Las Vegas vernacular? It seems to me like this Mediterranean style is so prevalent, but because Las Vegas is such a unique area, it seems like there would be something more fitting.
Yeah, well, is there a term of art for this kind of architecture?
We would probably have to make one up. I think it's Desert Mediterranean.
You heard it here first. We're talking today about the casino industry, the design of casinos of today and of the future, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. Along with gambling, Las Vegas casinos are known for their glitzy shows. We're talking light years from showgirls here. Many of the effects incorporated have gotten so complex that the University of Nevada at Las Vegas has a department devoted to educating the entertainment engineers of tomorrow. Robert Boehm joins us now. He's a professor of mechanical engineering and director of the Energy Research Center at UNLV's College of Engineering. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
As MBA and economists take over casino management, are engineers replacing theater designers?
Well, I don't know that they're replacing it, but traditionally these shows have been generated by people with theater backgrounds. And what has happened over the last really 20 years now is these shows in general have become so technical that the theater people need some help from people who know something about the technology. And as a result, we find a lot of companies who have this sort of bifurcated form where they have theater background as well as engineering.
Theater background as well as engineering. Now, you have a program with Cirque du Soleil, which has itself 4 shows here, some in facilities designed specifically for that show.
Yes. In fact, Cirque is a very good example of a company that has used these high-tech kinds of approaches with the owners of the casinos to give a very educational and entertaining kind of experience all in the same time. You know, a lot of these shows have flying associated with them, human flying. Now, human flying goes back to the Greeks. They did it a long, long time ago. But, boy, the way this has taken form in something like the Ka show at the MGM Grand is just amazing, how we have so many people flying so many different directions, doing so many different things. And the stage there, how it rotates up vertically and does all kinds of amazing things. These are the kinds of things that the hotels, I think, find very profitable in appealing to our 40 million tourists, roughly, who come from all corners of the world, who maybe a lot of them can't even understand English, but these kinds of shows speak to them very closely.
Yet the competition, I mean, Hollywood movies spending $140 million for special effects, even Broadway theater has got some pretty wow stuff. The competition out here is pretty amazing. What are we talking about in terms of financing one of these big Cirque du Soleil shows?
Well, it's I don't know all the prices on them, but they are a very big expenditure. I remember when Siegfried and Roy was placed in the Mirage. It had one of the biggest price tags to that point of any show. And money makes money, and that's what's happening here, is we're finding very big expenditures to achieve these special effects and special entertainment kinds of experiences.
Jen?
When they first built Siegfried and Roy, it was a $30 million theater. When they did Celine Dion, it was a $70 million theater. And it goes back to how you look at your customer. If you said to old Las Vegas, we're going to spend $70 million for a theater for a performer, and it's a good idea, everybody would have said, you're nuts. But what they understand today is that their customer wants that experience, and it's been very, very successful for Caesars, irrespective of the huge price tag to put it up.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and this is Dale in Watertown, South Dakota.
Hello, how you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
I was marketing director for Debbie Reynolds Hotel and Casino back in the early 90s, back when Jan was mayor, as a matter of fact, when I thought she was an excellent mayor.
Thank you.
And, you know, we were a block off the strip, and we tried all kinds of things, but we couldn't get anybody to Debbie's show. And that was pretty much when all the big hotels were opening up, and everybody was attracted to the Flash and the Treasure Island, the Luxor, and all the big ones. And I was just wondering, the smaller hotels nowadays, do they really have a chance with any entertainment, or is everybody going to the big hotels?
Well, why don't we put that to Bo Bernhardt?
I actually wanted to point out that Debbie Reynolds is responsible for perhaps one of the best quotes on the mafia era of this town when she said that Las Vegas was a much better run town at that point, and wasn't, and also was fond of saying that nobody got killed that didn't deserve killing.
And her opinions are her own.
Right, right. But she certainly recognized you know, the importance of that era.
Dale, thanks very much for the phone call. We'll try to bring you an answer after the break when we return, but appreciate the phone call. We're talking about the future of hotels, casinos, and the Strip in Las Vegas. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.